I'd like to start off by saying that there are several of you who have asked me about the subject of fasting, and I have some instructions here just for people who might like to fast. Ordinarily, I don't recommend that when you're in a program like this that you do fasting, because it's strenuous enough for the body anyway, and besides that, you want to sample all the foods that they're making here so that you can see what they are and go back home and produce those in your own kitchen. But there may be some of you who would like to have this kind of information, so I've written out some instructions here that I would like to have. I think that I wrote these out for you, didn't I? Okay, so I'll have these up for you later, and you can just pick these up, and anybody else who would like just to see the instructions can see this lady right over here. One of the most important things giving us resistance against disease is that of proper character development. And I cannot overemphasize that our character development, more than any other single thing, has to do with length of life and freedom from disease. And therefore, if a physician does not have as a part of his armamentarium of things that he teaches his patients, that of good character development, that of getting proper discipline in the life, then that physician is not going to be as good for the person's overall health in the long run as he could be if he did have that as a part of his instruction. Now, let me tell you why that is. It has to do with the immune system. The immune system is controlled by the brain itself, and we cannot at all have a properly functioning immune system if we are guilt-ridden and filled with jealousy and we're discontented and we have no order and system in our lives. We have no organization and government in our lives, and therefore we are sort of at loose ends much of the time, and just we're living a hand-to-mouth existence without order. This kind of program leads to a weakened immune system. My studied opinion is that many of those who come down with such serious immune deficiency diseases as AIDS and other immune deficiency diseases, that one reason for that is that their lives are in a turmoil. Now, that's not the only reason why people get the immune deficiency diseases. People who are quite well disciplined to do themselves occasionally come down with some kind of problem that could lead to a serious immune deficiency breakdown. But generally speaking, we can believe that if people will be perfect in their character development, that they're going to live longer, they're going to be more free from disease. Now, this is not just an opinion that I'm giving you that I think might be correct. This has been scientifically proven, that people who are religious recover from operations quicker. They recover from childbirth quicker. If they have an accident in an automobile, they recover from it quicker. If you take 10,000 people in each of these categories and just take a survey on them, you will find that the more religious, the more deeply concerned the individual is, generally speaking, the more healthy and the easier that person can recover from disease. And so with those remarks, I make no apology to you for telling you that I'm going to be talking with you about some things dealing with character. And as a physician, I would like to share with you things that can assist you to understand the brain and its workings. So I'd like to start out by giving you a little overview of neurophysiology. As you know, the brain has this kind of appearance, with the frontal lobe being up here and the eyes being right under here, like this. Now, the brain is a most marvelous instrument. There is no computer that does more than just mimics one tiny aspect or two of the many millions of different kinds of activities, shades of meanings, and very small differences in the work that the brain can do. To give you an example, the reaction that a person has to a room is altogether different that is the reaction that a person viewing a room has, is altogether different if there are minor changes in that room, such as an aisle put down the middle, or baskets not hanging, or baskets hanging. Very minor changes make a difference in the impression that a person gets of the room, and make a difference in the reaction that the person has to everything that goes on in that room. It is for this reason that people who are in real estate, who have studied the psychology of these things, make very certain about some things. They will make suggestions to the householder. If you will move this over here instead of there, it will make a better impression when I bring people in to view the house. It is this same kind of thing that makes lecturers choose one color carpet over another color carpet, or one color of blinds over another color of blinds. These things are things that are well known in psychology. Shadings of work that the brain can do that nothing else known to man can do. In this way, we have been made in the image of God with the millions of different kinds of reactions and actions and productivity and sensitivities and criticisms and just the mind is staggered to even try to understand what the brain can do. And that the brain itself can study about itself is another of the miracles of the Lord. Now, what I have just drawn is the anatomical organization of the brain. Now, let's take a different kind of organization, and that is the psychological organization of the brain. The psychological organization of the brain can be illustrated in this way, that we have will as the capital, and we have desire as the lower nature, and we have the hemispheres, both right and left, as the thinking part and the memory part of the brain. Each part has its own function. The will is the governing power in the experience of man. Desire is both good and bad, as is will. Will is both good and bad. Will, if it is determined and will carry one's life right down to death in order to gratify self, then it is a bad will. It is an untrained, undisciplined, disorganized will. If desire will put oneself into hock for the rest of one's lifetime in order to gratify present desires, that is a poorly trained desire. But there are good desires as well. The desire for one's proper food. There is nothing wrong with our enjoying good food. Our divine designer made us so that we could enjoy the food that is required to keep ourselves in good health. He also makes it so that we enjoy the society of one another. Nothing wrong with that, as long as it is in proper bounds and is along the biblical outlines that we have been given. Now, there are different things that go on in each part of the various aspects of the brain. In fact, we have more organs of the brain than we have organs of the body, even if you count every single hair follicle as a separate organ. The brain is enormously complex. Now, let's just take what goes on in the right hemisphere. There are some special things that go on there that don't go on in the left hemisphere, generally speaking. We have creative things that go on here. And those creative things include such things as architecture and art. That's art appreciation, not the actual painting or drawing of things. That's music appreciation and conceptualization. That's also such things as executive ability. And that's such things as common sense. And that's also such things as art forms, art appreciation and art forms and art balance and things of that nature. A lot of things that are creative, and religion is over here as well. Trust, however, is a left hemisphere function. And also in the left, the scientific and practical things. These things include such things as math and playing a musical instrument. Do you see the difference? One has to do with a physical skill, and the other has to do with the creativity of music. Two altogether different things, and a person may be a very accomplished musician, but not able to compose a single line of music. Also, the left hemisphere has to do with such things as reading and writing and arithmetic and the skills that we learn in school. Those kinds of things are left hemisphere functions. It is a fact that when a person is growing up, he begins very early to lateralizing information. In the first 10 years of life, the right hemisphere is 90% dominant. And so if you start training the left hemisphere early in life, it will be with great difficulty, and it will also be at the expense of the right hemisphere. I believe that there is a design against the proper training of children by pushing them too early into school so that we will not be able to train this right hemisphere so well. We will not be so creative. We will not have so much common sense. We will not have so much religion, because the great enemy of our souls would like it if we did not have a well-developed right hemisphere. Little boys are far more influenced by this than are little girls, because little girls do not lateralize so distinctly and completely as little boys. Therefore, if a woman has a lesion in the left hemisphere that wipes out her math area, it will be altogether different than if a man has a left hemisphere lesion, like a tumor or a stroke, that knocks out the math part of the brain. For a man who has his math part of the brain wiped out, he will not even be able to recognize that this is a numeral instead of a letter. A woman, on the other hand, who has the same size lesion, because she has a little math tucked away down here somewhere in the right hemisphere, she will be able still to do some minor figuring, even though she has had the same size or even larger lesion on the left side to wipe out that part of her brain. Now, the same thing over here on the right side. If we have a tumor that knocks out music, for a man, he may not even recognize that a piano is playing. He may just know that something is sounding. There is some noise or some sound. Whereas a woman may even still be able to play the piano a little bit if she has the same kind of lesion involving the same size and same area of the brain, because of the fact that she has a little music tucked away over here in the left side of the brain. Now, in one sense, women are superior in that way, but because of the specialization that men have, they are more creative, more skilled at reading when they are skilled. The greatest musicians who have ever lived, the greatest architects, the greatest artists who have ever lived, even the greatest creative cooks are men. We pay a price for our lack of specialization, but it is a protection under certain circumstances. And to show all of the aspects of God, God made both men and women, both feminine brain and masculine brain. And as Dr. Blake said the other day, it would be well if we appreciated what we are, because what I am is specific. It shows something special, something that no one else in all the universe can show about God. I am a special person. And for me to spend all my time trying to be like somebody else or trying to do what they can do. I can't do what they can do. I can only do what I can do. Now, if I am deficient in something that I ought to be up on, then I ought to start trying to work a little bit to develop skills that I ought to have, that I just haven't developed, that I really need. Then it's perfectly proper for me to work on those skills. But for me to have any degree of remorse because I am not a man, it's wasted time and wasted effort. I can never be a man, nor can I ever do the things that men can do. There are some things I can never do, and for me to be remorseful about it would be a waste of time, a waste of my energy and effort. And so we should appreciate what we are. If we recognize that what I am reflects something about the character and personality and productivity of God, then I can be satisfied with myself, happy with myself, and desirous of doing good. Now, can you see the reason that I have presented this to you this morning? What do you think is the reason? Who has a thought?
But the women lead.
What is that?
That means to have forget about the women lead.
Oh, yes, women's lib. I'm opposed to that. Now, that's one reason. I'm glad you bring that up. What's another?
Homosexuality,
that's another thing. But that's still not my primary reason. That's a good thing. I'm glad you brought that up. Yes. Yes, God gave us each a specific role, and He wants us to express that, but that's still not my major reason. Yes.
The function of the brain is how
we think. Yes, how we think and how the organization of the brain is, that's another thing. That's still not my primary reason. Yes.
It has to do with how it's our desire or will go through the forming of our character.
That's a very important part. Desire is a very, we should develop desire in a proper way. We should understand how will is involved in controlling desire. The will should be counseled by the things that we have learned, the memory that we have, and the reason that we have. By the way, reason is a left hemisphere function. We learn reason by training. The same kinds of things that we can learn from books, those kinds of things are left hemisphere functions. But the reason that I bring this up has to do with the 90% dominance before the age of 10. That's what I want to tell you about. If we start training the left hemisphere with reading, writing, arithmetic, and playing a musical instrument before the age of 10, the more before the age of 10 that it is, the more we're going to damage the right hemisphere. And so before the age of 10, children should be free as lambs. They should be able to roam the countryside really well. They should get their training down by the stream and out under the trees and in the flower beds and in the gardens, not so much in the classroom. We may have family worship for our children, but they should not be lengthy, an hour or two. A child should not be seated for thoughtful learning for that long a period of time. They can be taught how to sing, but it should be by hearing the songs and not by reading the songs. Let us be careful of that point. It's an important one. Question back here.
Yes, but are you advocating that we ought to try to practice that in this day and age?
I knew that was going to be my first question. The first question is, what are we going to do since our state laws say that this child shall be in school at the age of, what is it now in this state? Six, five, some of you. And in some states it's four, and some it's even three. Yes. Did you hear that? In Pennsylvania, it's the day before you're nine. Well, well, that's a progressive state. That's a progressive state. They've been studying neurophysiology, and they understand something about these. If we want to have our children to develop in a way so that they can become executives, so that they can have good common sense, so that we can train them in religion, so that we can train them to be strongly moral. We need to have plenty of time for them to be at home with mom and dad. And by the way, that was no mistake when I said mom and dad. Children need their dads also. And some of your leisure hours, fathers, should be given to your children. Do you know the average length of time that the American child spends conversing with his father every day? It's less than 1 minute. Less than 1 minute, something like 59 seconds. That's an actual dialogue with the father. They have less than 1 minute per day. One of the big reasons for that has to do with television. Now, I'll take a few questions. So those of you who have questions right now, raise your hands and I'll answer those, but then we need to go on to another part of our program. You had a question and then yours.
I have a question. I was going to add to what she said about entering school, but if they enter before age 9, they must continue, you know, without being in trouble.
You mean they have to be in a home school before the age of 9?
They don't have to start until age of 9, but if they do, then they can't drop out again. They must continue.
Oh, yes, yes. But once they start school at the age of 9, I would think that they would then have to continue.
I was wondering if the law and the states that children under the age of 10 can be taught at home, if there is a qualified teacher in the family.
All right.
Here's
the question that I was expecting would come up and hoping would, and that is about homeschools. Can you do homeschooling? There are some who can. If there is a qualified teacher in the home, then that teacher should teach the children. Now, what is a qualified teacher? A qualified teacher is a teacher who is a person, an adult of ordinary intelligence, who loves those children. Usually that's the mother. That mother will be a better teacher for her children than any other individual. I know whereof I speak, because the one who knows has said that that is the case, that the mother and the father should be the only teachers until the child is 8 or 10 years of age, and that is the most ideal. Now, let me postulate something for you. Let us say that a child is born into a family where the father burns the child with cigarettes every time he gets a chance, and the mother cuffs and beats the child around, and they both ignore the child or leave the child alone and to watch TV all they can. Should those parents teach these children? I say send that child to school as early as you can, where there are some, and if necessary, you may even remove them from that home altogether and put them in a foster home. That's not the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I'm talking about an ideal parent who loves the child, who is concerned, who is willing to say, I will set aside whatever things I might want to do myself in order that I may take this block of time and spend it teaching my children. Now, a woman who teaches her children at home is not going to be like a school teacher who rings the bell and the children come in, and then she says at the end of the class day, after 5 or 6 hours, she says, goodbye, children, I'll see you again tomorrow. The mother doesn't have that. She is with them all the time. Therefore, father needs to come and take the children some so that she can have, or some other person who is responsible, who can take the children and train them, should take the children and train the children for a time while the mother has some surcease from the constant companionship of small children. She needs some adult companionship and some time alone and not to be constantly with the children. Now, another word.
I'm asking, is it legal?
Yes, it's legal in most states. Now, if it isn't legal, I would stand for my rights right up to the Supreme Court for the right to train my children at home, because this is a God-given right, and I believe that we can do that kind of thing. Now, the next thing that I'd like to say has to do with other people's children coming to visit your children. So far as I am concerned as a physician and as a mother and as a concerned civil person, spend-the-night parties are a no-no, with no exceptions. If my children spent the night in some other home, I spent the night there too. And they slept right beside my bed. No sleeping in the same beds with children. Children should not sleep together with children of another family. That's an important point. Children teach each other evil better than they teach each other good, more easily than they teach each other good. And also, we are told that, quote, the eye of experience should be always over children. So if your children are playing with another person's children, don't say, well, children, go out to the park and I'll see you all later. Come back at, don't be late. Come back because I'll have lunch ready at, none of that. If they go to the park, mother goes with them. If they go out to play in the yard, mother goes with them. Or somebody goes with them. If she can't go with them, if it's time to set the table, it's everybody come in now. You get the plates. You get the forks. You get the spoons and set the table while mother does some things here. And they are in the same room with her when they're with children from another family. That's a rule of life. They must always be with the mother when there are children visiting. And if you don't have time to do that, then you say, well, Johnny, I don't have time to play with you today with Melissa. You must go home now. And don't hesitate to do that. You are responsible before God for the training of your children. And so you can tell them. You can feel free to tell them. But when you have time, it's all right for Johnny to come and visit. But if Johnny teaches your children some kind of wrong words or wrong attitudes, Johnny cannot come at all. And if necessary, you must move out of the neighborhood. Now, let me see how much time I have. We've got so many things that we have to cover that I don't know whether I can spend more time. Those of you who have questions or comments right now, raise your hand and we'll take only these. One here and then one there. And I think that's number three. Anybody else? We'll take these three and that's all. Number one.
Okay, my daughter is in a dilemma right now because she has kept her daughter home and taught her.
Uh-huh.
She's 18. Now she's looking uh-huh. for a school to put her in.
Uh-huh.
But at the early stage of that, she had three students that she taught.
Uh-huh.
But now she's looking for where to put the child, and right now uh-huh. she's very quite stressful over that.
Yes.
But it is. She has taught that child up to age 13.
That's good.
Beautiful.
Now let me tell you something that we have discovered, that if a child does not go to school until, let's say, age of 10, at the age of 10, when the child starts to school, the child will do the first three grades in the first year. Year number two, they will do two more grades. Year number three, they will do two more grades. So that in 3 years, they will have covered seven grades. They will be ahead of the children who have spent all that time trying to cover the same material. When they graduate from high school, they'll be at least 2 years ahead, if not three.
She's all in
here.
She's uh-huh. stressed with everything.
Yes.
But she's very stressful because she can't find the proper school that she really wants
yes.
to go into.
All right. Now, let me continue one step farther, and that is this. I don't know whether a person could continue to train a child all the way. It depends on the training and the predisposition of the teacher. But I know at least one teacher who taught her children all the way through high school. They finished up at high school in the mother's home school. One of the girls, there were four children, one of them decided she wanted to study medicine after she got through with a home school. Well, she was already advanced almost through college by the time she had gotten to the point of being ready to graduate from high school. But by that time, by the time she decided she wanted to study medicine, she was probably 23 years of age. But she had had all of this training that would take her to what would be the equivalent of maybe the third year in college. But she'd had no college, no formal schooling of any kind. So she went down and took a GED test. She scored so high that they didn't know what to do with her. She was way high, way past being a freshman. And so she began to take equivalency tests. So she took equivalency tests, and they put her at about the third year in college. So she spent about a year and a half or two finishing up college, and then went to medical school, finished number one in her class at Loma Linda in medicine. So I just want to tell you the quality of good quality homeschooling. You do not have to feel that it's going to be inferior. Any time that we do what the Lord tells us to do, it's going to be a superior program, isn't it? Yes, number two.
Uh-huh. She's done well until the last year. She has lost interest now.
Uh-huh.
In school, where she does not want to. What can I do to help her?
All right, there are things that you need to do, and I would suggest that you get in touch with Dr. Raymond Moore, who is a specialist in this area. He is the head of the Hewitt Research Institution in Washougal, Washington, and you can get some good counsel from him on that. Question number three.
He's just brought on to reflect you that 55% of homes have single parents. What is the next best thing then if you have to go out?
All right, that's a good point. What if you are a single parent? Get together with another single parent. Whichever one has the highest paying job, go and work and support both families and both schools. And let one parent school the children and the other person goes out and makes money to support them. You might even get another little family who would join, who wanted to have a home school. And maybe you would have three or four students in the school. You might even get a mother who is not working to join with you in that to help with the school. When there are several students, it's good to have more than one student, one teacher in a home school. That's a home school setting. Yes.
Okay, the church schools that are existing now.
Yes. All right, the question is about the church schools of today. I'm very thankful for the church schools of today. And if you must put your children in a church school, by all means do. But if you can homeschool your children, I really think it's the best. That's my studied opinion, having gone around quite a great deal and seen a lot that's going on in schools today. So, anyone who would like to have more information on this can get some more information by reading the books that Dr. Raymond Moore has written, and also some people at the University of California at Berkeley have written a lot on the subject of too early schooling for children. One of the psychologists in the department there studying this matter of lateralization and the matter of sending children to school too early, said sort of with tongue in cheek, he says, a little boy is uneducable before the age of 10. I say that the most important thing that this future priest in the household is going to have done for him is done by the age of 10, because he will have already set all that he is, the major part that he is going to have in the way of common sense and religion, and a number of other very important right hemisphere functions by the time he is 10 years of age. It's a very important teaching time. Now, there is another very important thing that you should get if you want to train your children properly, and that's something that you will find back on the American Cassette Ministries education materials table, and that's Train Up a Child. This very fine series by Stephen Wallace you will find inspiring to you if you're a parent. Now, let's say you're not a parent. Let's say you're a grandmother, and your great-great-grandmother, and all your children are past the age of 18. Great children also, great-grandchildren. You will still want to listen to this because it has a lot to do with character development. Now, here is one, From Glory to Glory. This is number 3, which tells about such things as human relationships. It tells about your relationship with God. It gives you very good tips on how to pray, how to read your Bible. on how to develop the kind of character that you need to develop for this last age of Earth's history. Then here is another one. This one is by Carol Zarska. This is Christ in the Sanctuary. In this series, she teaches you how to pray through the sanctuary. She teaches you also many of the meanings of the symbolism of the sanctuary, but especially she teaches you about character development in that. Here is one by Clifford Goldstein. This cassette tape is called Satan's Fatal Sophistry. This is a very popular tape, and in one meeting where the American Cassette Ministries distributed this tape, they had a large number of the tapes, but when people started listening to it and talking with others about how good it was, they had to order back for some more. And those were sold out, they had to order back for some more. And those sold out, and they had to order back for some more. So it's a very good tape. I haven't myself listened to it, but I understand that it's quite good. Satan's Fatal Sophistry. It deals with deceptions, and we need to know about that in our day. Some of you will know Cliff Goldstein as the editor of the New Israelite Shabbat Shalom. Yes. And then there are a number of tapes that I have back on the cassette ministry's table that you will want to go back and take a look at. Several of you have disorders or discomforts that would be well treated with an oil-free diet. We have a book called Eat for Strength Oil-Free. It has recipes in it that you will find easy to follow and inexpensive, and I think that there are many of you who would profit from following a book such as Eat for Strength. We also have the Country Life Cookbook for sale in the camp, and we also have of these You May Freely Eat, Joanne Rocker's little book. In Joanne Rocker's little book, there are a number of recipes for making fruit smoothies. If you have not had delicious fruit smoothies, make them according to the way that you like fruit smoothies. You need to get Joanne's little book, Of These You May Freely Eat, and see her various ice creams. And if you have any questions about those, see Flo Smith. Flo, would you raise your hand back there? Flo is our cooking consultant, and anyone who would like to get, again, Flo, there's still some who need to see who you are. She can tell you about recipes. She was the manager of the restaurant at Country Life for quite some time, and she and I and another lady sort of alternate back and forth cooking in my home. Recently, Flo hasn't had much of an opportunity to cook, and we're all sorry for that, because she knows how to handle foods. Now, I want to tell you about one more book, and that's Creation's Tiny Mystery. This is written by Dr. Robert Gentry, and if you know anyone who is not a Seventh-day Adventist, get this book for them. It will substantiate the reason why we believe in the Sabbath. And there is no reason for us to worship Christ apart from the fact that He is the Creator. In the Revelation, it says, worship Him, for He is worthy to be worshipped because He created all things that are in heaven and earth and the sea below. So the reason why we worship Jesus is because He is the Creator. That is His reason for being worshipped. That's the credentials that He gives us for asking for our worship. This book, if anybody reads it, now it isn't written on the second grade level, but anybody who has finished the eighth grade in school will be able to read this and understand it. You can't read it as you would a comic book. You have to put your mind in high gear when you read it. But there isn't a person here who could not read this book and understand it, including these children, if they've gotten as far as the eighth grade. What you need to recognize is that it is logical and reasonable to believe that the earth was only created 6,000 years ago, as the Bible indicates. It is also reasonable to believe, it is in fact scientifically coercive to believe that the earth was created in 6 literal days. And so I believe that if you will read this book, anybody with a candid mind reading this book will believe that the earth has to be only a few thousand years of age. The scientific evidence is coercive. That means it allows for no other interpretation except that. Now, at this time, Cal Thrash is going to talk with you about that remedy that I feel is one of the most important remedies that we can have to ensure our success in treating disorders through the time of trouble, since it is so easily available in many places. I think that the Lord has specially given it to us for this particular age of Earth's history.
I knew the ties were good for something. How many of you were at the meeting that we held yesterday in the church? So we have several who were there. Now you're putting me on the spot. See, I've got to do something different. Does anybody know about the action of charcoal and really what charcoal does? Has anybody really used it? Okay, so we're not beginners. I want to discuss some external uses of charcoal very quickly, and then some internal uses of charcoal, and then tell you a little bit about why charcoal works like it does. We had a lady to move to Uchi Pines, and she came from the Pacific Northwest. Now, coming from the Northeast, if you've never been in the South, you won't know what I'm speaking of either, possibly. But if you have been in the South, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say fire ants. Does anybody know what fire ants are? Fire ants are vicious little creatures. They're mad. They're always mad. You can see one crawling along like any other ant would, with a little piece of something in his mouth, or whatever you call those things. And you can divert him by putting your finger down there, and he will try to bite you. Now, most ants won't do that. Like a sugar ant will take off in the other direction. But a fire ant will drop what he's got and put his whole focus of attention on your finger to try to get through that skin. And he'll curl up in a little ball, and he'll try to sting you on one end and bite you on the other. They're vicious little creatures. They make a mound, and if you don't know what the mound is all about, you may step right in it and be hoeing in your garden or something else. And in the meantime, you have several hundred of these little vicious creatures crawling up your legs or getting in your shoes or wherever they can get a hold. And that's what happened to this one young lady. Actually, it's happened several times at Uchi Pines since we are infested with these little things. Like to get rid of them, but as far as I know, there's no known cure. They just keep on going. And she stepped in this. Now, it was in a in some hay, and you know, if they're in hay, they will pull the dirt up, but it doesn't make, so a lot of times they don't make a mound on the top, so you don't realize they're there. You may move the hay around and you just don't see them, and they can crawl all over you, and that's what happened to her. Over and bit her dozens of times on her legs, and then when she tried to brush them off, they bit her on her hands. Well, she had never come in contact with a fire ant before, and so this was literally being baptized with fire. And she broke out in a generalized reaction to the fire ant bites all over. Eyes swelled shut. Face blew up in just huge. And she looked terrible and she felt terrible and she thought, I'm going to die. I got to do something about this. So she was taken to our conditioning center. And what do you suppose they put in the whirlpool bath that they gave her? Charcoal. Now, in a case like this where it's an almost emergency type of a situation, a lot of times you don't take the time to sit down and say, now, how much of this should I use? I think I should use half a cup or how much? You just open it up and dump some into a bath and put the person right in it. Now, it took a little while, but within about 15 minutes, her hives and generalized reaction was starting to subside, and they made her sit in that whirlpool for about an hour, I believe, in the charcoal, and then by that time she was starting to subside, and they were able to make some charcoal poultices and put them actually on the lesions where she was actually bitten, and she didn't have any more of the generalized reaction. Charcoal works fast. That's something that you'll need to remember. If you get a bee sting, and even if you're not severely allergic to it, but you just want to make sure that it doesn't swell up terribly, like for instance if you get one on your face and you don't want to have your face to look strange like you have a grapefruit on one side, charcoal immediately, a poultice right on that, as quickly as possible, is the treatment of choice. And it will pull the poison away from the sting and keep the swelling down, and of course you'll need to keep the poultice on for as long as possible until, of course, the swelling does actually go away and the reaction is gone. I had a situation also several years ago where I had hives, and has anyone had hives before? I didn't even know what caused the hives. It must have been something that I ate, but it could have been related to some kind of an insect bite. In fact, I believe it probably was because I had a bite of some sort on my hand, and I remember the morning that I got the hives, I was sitting in morning worship, and I was just kind of idly scratching that bite, whatever it was, and all of a sudden, it just felt like my whole arm was swelling to twice its size, and I kind of looked at it to see if it really was, and I felt itchy on my back, and just felt like ants were crawling all over me, and fire ants too. And I went into the bathroom and took off my shirt, and I was just covered with a rash. And I immediately drew the bath and put in some charcoal, and it didn't go away right away. It did go away as far as the hives subsided right then, but I mean it kept coming back for several days, and that's what makes me think that it's possible that it could have been something I ate. I don't know. But it can be used in hives, and I intermittently would take these baths, and of course I took it easy for a couple of days until it actually started going away. As soon as I would feel the hives coming on, I'd get back in the bath and put the charcoal in. And I didn't have to have a bath that would come right up to my neck. I could just have a fairly shallow bath. As long as the water was fairly hot and I had the charcoal in it, the hives would almost immediately subside. And so that was, to me, proof that charcoal was fast and effective. A lady came to us in the later stages of cancer. It had spread to most parts of her body, and she had her kidneys to be affected by the cancer, and she had almost total renal dysfunction. She wasn't even really, her kidneys just weren't cleaning her blood at all, pretty much. And this was causing her blood urea, which, don't quote me on this, but I believe that the blood urea is supposed to be somewhere around 6 or 5, and hers was in the realm of 400, just incredibly high. And she was in pain as a result of this, and it clouds your mind too when your blood is impure and you can't think. You start going in her mind. She was just literally losing her mind. We put charcoal poultices, large ones, on her back, covered as much of her of the area close to her kidneys as we could with charcoal poultices, and that literally pulled the poisons from her blood through her skin, through the sweat glands, and she was able to it relieved some of her pain. Now, of course, it didn't cure the cancer. I'm not trying to say that. And she ultimately did die from the cancer because it was in such an advanced stage, but at least it helped her clear her mind, and she was able to be comfortable for the time that remained for her. So external uses are definitely something that you can use the powder for. And it's probably the most versatile. The powder is probably the most versatile because it can be used either internally or externally. It would be a little bit hard to open up capsules to make enough to be able to use it externally. So even though the capsules or the tablets are very simple and easy ways to take it internally, it's not really the most effective, most fast, and most versatile way to have charcoal in your home. A man came to me just about a week ago when I was talking about charcoal and said, I'd like to relate to you a experience that I had with charcoal. And I said, great, because I'm always willing to listen to the charcoal stories. I need more of them. And he said, I had an eye infection that my eyes were watering. It obviously was something that kept coming back. He had used some kind of drops that the doctor had prescribed for him and several other types of remedies that he had tried. Nothing really had worked. Well, it had worked, but it hadn't made it go away until he used charcoal. Now, charcoal on the eyes, using charcoal, you know, for the eyes is a little bit tough because, of course, when you put it on, you can't see anything. You can't see what you're doing. You can't pin it back very well. But he was able to make the poultice, and then he just laid it on his, of course, kept his eyes closed, laid it on his the external, and then put a towel over that and went to sleep on that. And the next morning he was feeling much better, didn't have the irritation, so he was, when he got off work, he did the same thing, and within a couple of days it cleared up, and he hadn't gotten it back when he told me the story, which had been, I think, several months since he had done this. So charcoal is very effective for that. Something else you can use charcoal for that you may not have thought about, or you may have thought about, and that is deodorization. You can use charcoal in your refrigerator. Take a cap similar to the kind of cap that we have on this charcoal, a bottle cap of some sort, and fill it up with charcoal and set it in the back of your refrigerator, and it will pull the odors into that. Change it every couple of weeks if you have a real bad refrigerator, but every month or so if you don't have something that's very odoriferous in there, and it will pull the odors to it and keep your refrigerator smelling nice. And of course it can be used for other deodorization problems also. Internal uses of charcoal. Some, I'll try to think of some that I didn't bring out yesterday. Can be used for bad breath. Either bad breath that's just from some kind of problem with your teeth, maybe you need to have just in your mouth. You can either use it as a mouthwash. Of course, you'd want to brush your teeth very good after you got done using it because it'll leave them looking kind of strange. Or for metabolic problems that cause bad breath. Sometimes people find that when they fast, they get bad breath. And it can be used both internally, can be swallowed, and also used as in the mouthwash type of a thing. Mixed fairly liquid and then just swish it around your mouth and swallow it if it's a metabolic type of a thing, or spit it out, either one. It also has been used, dentists use charcoal to whiten people's teeth. That sounds a little strange, being as how it's black, but it does work. In fact, charcoal is used to purify sugar. That's what makes sugar white. Of course, it's bone black. I won't recommend that you use that. But charcoal can be used to whiten things and can be used to whiten your teeth. Take stains off your teeth. You just mix up a little paste of it and put it up, brush your teeth with it, and then... If you do have a problem with stained teeth, leave it on for a few minutes and then rinse it off, and over a period of time it will help to whiten your teeth that way.
Question.
Yes.
What about eating onions and garlic? Will it take that taste, that smell away from your breath?
It will work somewhat. But I don't think that it will.
Not completely.
It won't cure it. Won't cure it. In fact, I don't know anything that will really take garlic breath completely away, other than just time. Yes, back in the back. Okay, I'll try to. No, it's a little bit of noise in the back. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. A couple came to us. This was also about a week ago, after I had talked about charcoal. A couple came to us and said, I'd like to relate a story on charcoal with our baby. The baby was about a couple, I think 2 or 3 months old. And once again, I said, fine, because if any of you have stories on charcoal, I love to hear about stories on charcoal. And as you use it, you'll get more and more unusual stories about charcoal. But anyway, this couple had been planning to go on a trip for several weeks, and it just so happened that the week that they were getting ready to go, the stomach flu was going around, and their babies, the day they were going to go, the baby started to have a fever and be listless and had diarrhea, and it looked like the flu, it looked like they weren't going to be able to go. And so they were fretting and saying, well, we planned for weeks and now we're not going to be able to go, and we're very disappointed about the whole thing. They said, why don't we try charcoal and see if that'll work? Maybe we'll still be able to go. So they mixed up some charcoal, kind of liquid, kind of weak, and put it in a bottle and made a bigger hole in the nipple so it would come through, and gave it to the baby. And within minutes, just 5 or 10 minutes, the baby started to feel better. Now, you know how babies are when they get sick. They don't want to do anything. If you put them down, they just kind of lay there or cry. If you pick them up, they just want to be held close. And she started to be more active. The fever started to go down. She did continue to have a fever for the rest of the day, but the diarrhea went away. And they said, well, that's fine. We'll just take the charcoal along with us, and we'll start out, and if we have any problem, we'll turn around and come back. But they took the charcoal with them and were able to continue their trip and had no problem with the baby. And it just stopped the stomach flu right in its tracks and stopped the diarrhea also. I promised to tell you how it is that charcoal does all this. It's not mysterious, really. If you look at a grain of charcoal, well, first it starts out as the wood, and as it is burned, it burns little tunnels into the grain of the wood until finally, of course, if it doesn't, you don't take it all the way down to ash, but you leave it at the charcoal stage, and then there's hundreds of little tunnels in the grain itself. And I mentioned yesterday afternoon that if you take a cube 2/5 of an inch on each side, very small cube about the size of a sugar cube or smaller, 2/5 of an inch, that cube would have the surface area of 33 yards. In other words, 33 yards worth of surface area on that cube of charcoal. So you can see why it is that the charcoal is effective as it is, because you don't have to take that much, and it pulls the poisons into those little crypts and closes them off and keeps them in there, and then takes it on through or takes it away, and it attracts those chemicals to it so that it actually pulls, has an electrostatic charge that pulls those chemicals toward it and traps it away from the body, and then of course the body can do its job just that much more effectively without having those poisons present. Well, you may be saying to yourself, I'm never sick, I don't need this. I just never get sick. I don't think I'll need any charcoal. Don't kid yourself. You can use charcoal in all kinds of things, even intestinal gas, upset stomach, and you don't know when it's going to hit. That's why you need a can of charcoal in your kit that you keep with your home remedies book or your hydrotherapy book that you have. You need it in a good place where you know right where it is. And when your baby gets sick or you get sick or you have a rash of some sort, it's right there and you know where it is. Question in the back.
This is not a topic of story. It's something I want to know. And for folks listening, that they should exercise against more caution, when especially going to picnics and stuff. God, as I've heard, I've got a piece of sting.
Yes.
He was drinking a beer or some soda, and the sting, a bee got into the can.
Uh-huh,
and he drank the soda, got stung, and got killed, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Would that have saved him if he had grabbed it and soda or something?
I couldn't say in that particular case whether it would have, but I would say that would have been my first defense against the bee sting. Obviously, he was probably possibly allergic. Of course, it may have stung him several times.
Well, not really. I think what happened is he got down there and tore up. Defended from leaving.
Yes, I would have tried charcoal right away in that instance. I would have, because of the fact that charcoal works quickly, and it also works in more or less a systemic type of a way, then it probably would have helped him. Now he would have needed to call first aid right away too. But
careful with sodas and beers and stuff like that.
Right. In the front. About 2 tablespoons mixed into a glass of water. Approximately, if you had, let's say, an upset stomach, about a tablespoon or two mixed in a tall glass of water, and then you would drink that. If you have a problem drinking it, it really doesn't have a taste to it, but it has kind of a strange texture. And if you have a problem drinking it, try it with a little bit of fruit juice. If you really have trouble getting it down, it's possible that may help. Now, there's something to remember, and that is the charcoal is more effective to a certain extent the more you use it. It's not something you're going to overdose on, and especially if it's in a poisoning case like what the gentleman was mentioning. You would want to use it in copious amounts. We get used to using things in small amounts because of the fact that we've been used to using drugs for so long. Take 2 aspirin, call me in the morning, that kind of thing. If you're going to take capsules or tablets of charcoal, you won't just want to take 2. You want to take 5 or 10. It depends on what you need, really.
One way to get children to drink it is to mix it up and put a straw in it. If you have a chocolate milk carton, an empty one, put it in that and give them a straw, and they'll just drink it right down.
My 2-year-old likes the tablets. She just chews them up and swallows. She thinks it's great fun. In fact, she'll say, "Mommy, I'm sick. I need charcoal," just so she can get more charcoal. I'm sure that will probably end when she gets to the place where she can look at her teeth and see that they're getting black and so forth. And I don't know what we'll do then. But right now, she loves it. And my youngest doesn't seem to care. She just drinks it down. Yes, over here. Yes, it did in my case when I used it. Now, there is something you would want to remember, and that is when you make a poultice, or if you wanted to use, we've even used just the tablet itself, get it wet. Make sure that it stays wet.
Because it.
Cold or warm, either one, but just make sure that it stays wet as a poultice, because if you don't, then it will not be as effective. If it's dry and you set it on, it possibly might have some effect, but I tried one with a bee sting that was near my eye, and I put just a dry tablet on it, and it didn't do what I had expected. So you would want to make sure that it is wet in the front.
What about bronchitis?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
What about bronchitis? Are you able to use that with any effectiveness?
Out of my bailiwick now.
For bronchitis, I would go some other route. I would give hot baths, and I would give a glass full of water every 10 minutes for an hour for acute bronchitis. And if it's chronic bronchitis, I would find out what they're sensitive to, because chronic bronchitis almost always has a food as the basis of the chronic bronchitis.
In the front. If the case is an allergic type of poison ivy, now some people can just look at poison ivy and get it all over. In that kind of a case, it would be effective in that. Now, if it's someone who's not very allergic to it and they touch it and they get a little spot, I don't think it would be as effective in that as an allergic case. In fact, I tried it on some poison ivy that I got. I'm not very allergic, but I tried it anyway to see if it would help, and it didn't seem to do a whole lot of good. It didn't hurt anything, but I decided that would probably be treated in some other way, probably by trying to dry it out rather than use charcoal on it. So there are some, the general rule of thumb is, if it's wet, dry it with your skin. If it's dry, wet it. And so that's it.
Poison ivy, one thing that's nice is to take the inside of a banana peel and rub that all over it. That's good for poison ivy.
I'll take these two, and then we'll need to close on this. Yes. I believe so. Did you hear that question? What was the question again? Stasis ulcers, chronically ill and stasis ulcers.
All right. The question is about stasis ulcers. That's like ulcers that occur from varicose veins or bed sores or something of that nature. If it is smelly, use charcoal. It will deodorize a wound or a sore just in a matter of minutes, and it's very good for that. But for bed sores, to keep infection from developing in it, to use a little powdered sugar and just shake it on out of a salt shaker is good to reduce the infection in a bed sore or in a stasis ulcer. But the treatment of choice for a stasis ulcer due to varicose veins is the Unna boot, UNNA. Talk with your pharmacist and ask him about the Unna boot, UNNA, named for Dr. Unna, who developed it's a rigid bandage. Put one on, let it stay for about 3 days, 2 or 3 days, then cut it off with scissors and put another one on. It's easy and inexpensive if you can get a pharmacist who will make up the old-fashioned Unna paste for you. You have to stir it up with heat on the stove, but it's the best thing going for a stasis ulcer, for a varicose ulcer.
I just wanted to mention one other thing, and that is, and I'll be finished, and that is about the adsorptive power of charcoal, and that is, if you take ammonia gas, now it will adsorb ammonia gas, and that's also, you would want to keep this in mind as far as internal gas, intestinal gas, but ammonia gas, it will adsorb 8 to 1. It will adsorb 80 quarts to 1 quart of charcoal. So 1 quart of charcoal will adsorb 80 quarts of ammonia gas. Very powerful and very effective. In fact, Ellen White mentioned, in a humorous statement, she said that if I could name charcoal some outlandish name that no one but myself knew, it would probably have more power and more people would use it. And that's probably all.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.